Eric Gardner, John Crawford III, Michael Brown, Ezel Ford, Dante Parker, Michelle Crusoe, Laquan McDonald, Tanisha Anderson, Akai Gurley, Tamir Rice, Romain Brisbane, Jeremy Reed, George Mann, Matthew Ajabadi, Frank Smart, Natasha McKenna, Tony Robinson, Anthony Hill, Maya Hall, Philip White, Eric Harris, Walter Scott, William Chapman II, Alexia Christian, Brendan Glenn, Victor Manuel LaRosa, Jonathan Sanders, Freddie Blue, Joseph Mann, Salvato Ellswood, Sandra Bland, Albert Joseph Davis, Darius Stewart, Billy Ray Davis, Samuel Dubois, Michael Sabby, Brian Keith Day, Christian Taylor, Troy Robinson, Felix Kumai, Keith Harrison McLeod, Junior Prosper, Lamontas Jones, Patterson Brown, Dominic Hutchison, Anthony Ashford, Alonzo Smith, Tyree Crawford, India Kager, Levante Biggs, Michael Lee Marshall, Jamar Clark, Richard Perkins, Nathaniel Harris Pickett, Benny Lee Tignor, Miguel Espinal, Michael Knoll, Kevin Matthews, Betty Jones, Quintonio LeGreer, Keith Childress Jr., Janet Wilson, Randy Nelson, Atroni Scott, Wendell Celestine, David Josephs, Deshaun Perkins, Christopher Davis, Marco Loud, Peter Gaines, Tori Robinson, Darius Robinson, Kevin Hicks, DeMarcus Simler, Willie Tillman, Terrell Thomas, Seville Smith, Alton Sterling, Philando Castle, Terrence Crusher, Paul O'Neill, Alteria Woods, Jordan Edwards, Aaron Bailey, Ronell Foster, Stefan Clark, Antoine Rose II, Botham Jean, Pamela Turner, Dominic Clayton, Christopher Whitfield, Christopher McCorvey, Eric Reason, Freddie Gray, Michael Lorenzo Dean, Brianna Taylor, George Floyd. These are some of the names since just 2014 involving black men and women who died while in police custody or being placed into police custody, the most recent being George Floyd. Many people are saying George Floyd is going to be the last of the list as he leads change. I want to go back to words that were spoken the night before a tragedy brought a sad change, but nevertheless left a legacy. These are the words of Martin Luther King, who was addressing a Memphis audience involving, of all things, a strike of workers with the sanitation company on April 3rd, 1968, the day before he was assassinated.
Now let me say, as I move to my conclusion, that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strike, but either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus, and he wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. At points he wanted to trick Jesus and show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on the dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. And he talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite and a priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying this was the good man, this was the great man, because he had the capacity to project the eye into the thou and to be concerned about his brother. Now, you know, we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. The times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonial was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road.
That's right, that's right.
I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambushing. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by. And he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination, and let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing and I said, "Yes." The next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School." She said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, I want to say tonight that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream and taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. And to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
This past Tuesday, George Floyd was laid to rest in his hometown of Houston. Moving forward, there's something that needs to be made clear and given a full understanding to. George Floyd didn't die. He didn't pass away. His life wasn't, quote, tragically lost. Mr. Floyd wasn't taken from those he loved too soon. George Floyd was murdered by a thankfully now former Minneapolis cop, as three other thankfully now former Minneapolis cops stood, watched, and did nothing to stop a murder. Unless we all take that as our foundation, then moving forward will be more challenging than it certainly needs to be. And when I say moving forward, I'm not referring to the burial of George Floyd as the end of this. No, no, we are just getting started. Those who can see with honesty, the hundreds of thousands who have taken to the streets and the millions on social media who are demanding an end to police brutality, unequal justice, and rogue cops, are not going to just magically disappear like, well, I don't know, COVID-19, perhaps. When you look at the protesters in the streets, by the way, you don't just see black people. You're seeing all races, all faiths, and all genders who are telling our so-called elected leaders it's time for them to stop talking and time for them to start listening to we the people. Sadly, there are people in America who just don't see that there's been a long problem. Instead, when confronted with even video of acts of aggression and even violence by police officers, these people instead seek to fault the target of that aggression and violence. I mean, you've heard it. They have a criminal record as long as your arm. They shouldn't have been there. I had a gut feeling about that person. They agitated the situation, got what they deserved, and they were popular. It was a plot by some far-left group. Even if any or all of that was true, does it justify head blows that result in a concussion, a shove that cracks a skull open, or a death in the streets? As I watched the service for George Floyd this past Tuesday, I went over to the Facebook page for the Fox News channel to see what people were posting under the live video. It was well beyond sad. It was a rapid-moving crawl that was pathetic. Most common phrase among the many posts was, "I'm sorry he's dead, but..." Now, while not an official count on my part, other words and phrases I saw used frequently were "those people." There were some actually using the term "darkies" when the singing and the celebration of Mr. Floyd's life started happening. Saw the phrase "shuckin' and jivin'" go past my eyes frequently. And there was a variety of weight jokes as an ignorant reaction to the size of many of the people who were in attendance at the service. I really hope that the Fox News Channel hosts, anchors, executives see that Facebook thread and realize the type of venom that they're attracting. Many of the posters also attacked Fox News for airing the full service, saying they need to shut it off and go back to reporting, quote, real news. Of course, Al Sharpton, who was one of the people who gave a eulogy for Mr. Floyd, was the target of a bunch of venom as well. While Sharpton is not a saint, if you watch, you'd have to admit that if he didn't turn to being political, he would have made a great preacher, working that fire and brimstone, rocking from the pulpit. Quick story about Sharpton that I think proves he does have some redeeming qualities. There was a lame filmmaker who was doing a hit piece masquerading as a documentary about the talk show host Martin Downey Jr. long after he passed away. Moore passed away in 2001. This was 2015, I believe, give or take a year. They approached me to be a part of it because of my connection with Morton. I quickly refused once I understood what the mission of this effort was all about. Now, who did take part? People who Morton gave their really first major platform to is executive producer Bill Boggs, Gloria Allred, who never met a camera she didn't want to have sex with, and Curtis Sliwa, who always squawks about loyalty and honesty. They all took shots at Mort as they danced on his grave. Guess who refused to appear in this film? Right, Al Sharpton. So, points for him, at least in that regard. To those who are in denial about the poisonous element which exists within law enforcement, not in its entirety, but still a significant terminal infection, and all that poisonous element represents in racist beliefs and hostile attitudes about people who are supposedly different and want to block the efforts of those seeking to fix things. I have a question for you. Are you looking into a mirror, seeing too much of yourself, and that's why you want to turn away and have all of us turn away? Here's a better path. Seek God's grace. As the hymn says, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see."